to look at one of the big guys, one of the titans in U.S. Navy, and help make her what she is today. And we're going to look at a few questions of a gentleman called the Gun Doctor. He was an officer who over a century ago, he led a revolution in naval gunnery. He developed the torpedo boat and destroyer operations concepts. And during World War I, he served as a senior U.S. Navy commander in Europe, who my maternal grandfather served under on board the USS Arkansas. More than any man, he was instrumental in the establishment of the convoy system to help keep the United Kingdom from starvation in that conflict. And when he got through from that position, he let his star or two go away, and he went back to the Naval War College and helped establish a creative and innovative Navy that in the interwar period that we've discussed on many episodes here, developed the operational concepts for the submarines and aircraft carriers that led to our great victory in the Second World War shortly thereafter. What we're going to touch on today are looking back at what are those lessons that we can learn from what Admiral Sims wrote that don't just help us understand his period in time, but are very applicable to leaders serving in our Navy today. And we have an ideal person to discuss this and more. He's a returning guest, a regular friend of the show. We're really happy to bring on board Lieutenant Commander Benjamin Armstrong, United States Navy. Over at the show page and on our home blogs, you can find links for the book we're going to discuss today, 21st Century Sims, and also links to his first book, 21st Century Mahan. BJ is a naval aviator, believe it or not. And he served with the helicopter pilot flying amphibious search and rescue and special warfare missions, and he was the OIC of the Navy Helicopter Gunship Detachment deployed for counter-piracy and counterterrorism operations. He's a PhD candidate in the Department of War Study at King's College, London. BJ, welcome back to Midraps.
Captain Commander, thank you so much for having me back this afternoon. It's great to be with you.
I can already tell ahead of time this is going to be one of those shows that we're going to come up with just a couple minutes left and go, I've only got half my questions asked. But that's always a good sign, BJ. So settle in and get comfortable.
Yeah, I tend to filibuster.
Hey, I want to just kick off for maybe a lot of our listeners who aren't familiar with a gentleman that I know is a favorite of yours. You've written a book on him, and a lot of the regulars here enjoy as well. So just as a start off, who is Admiral William Sims, and why did you pick him as a follow-on to your first 21st Century Man?
Well, so Admiral William Sims is one of those figures in naval history, in American naval history, that because he predates World War II, the American consciousness tends to forget about. We sort of are a present-minded people, and our memory of history tends to be kind of short, particularly when we compare it to the memories of some folks in Europe or other parts of the world. Because Sims was a figure of World War I in the turn of the previous century, he's not particularly well known. However, during his career, he was a class of graduated from the Naval Academy in the 1880s and went through a period that was really the growth and birth of the great naval power that was the United States. It's the stuff that Captain Hendricks wrote about in his book on Teddy Roosevelt and the rise of the American Navy and the American beginning of the American century. And so Sims served throughout this period, you know, and bridges that introduction of steam power all the way through to the dreadnoughts and the submarines of World War I. So he saw and experienced a great deal. He also happened to be a bit of a troublemaker and a bit of an insurgent who wanted to make his Navy better. And so because of that, he did a lot of interesting things. And those reasons, as well as the centennial of our entry into World War I, all kind of added up to suggest that he might be a good person to pursue after the Mahan book had a little bit of success.
This book is about, I guess, 160 pages, and a lot of it is filled with, you've edited it so that it has his contributions featured prominently. And as I was reading through it, I kept thinking of the stuff we've seen recently of the modern influence of disruptive thinkers and innovation stuff, but Sims was kind of the first of the disruptive thinkers who really took a hold of the United States Navy, wasn't he?
Well, I don't know that I would necessarily say he was the first, although during his age, he was perhaps the most prominent and the most well-known in the Navy. And your observation of the connection to today's kind of innovation culture is absolutely spot on. And in fact, that's the very reason I started diving deep into Sims and what he did and what he wrote and thought about. I was invited to come to Navy Warfare Development Command several years ago when they held a symposium and a conference on junior military leader innovation. And they asked me to speak to an audience that was almost 300 people in person and another 200 via online, made up mostly of junior officers and enlisted personnel, to talk about how innovation happens or has happened in the Navy. Sims is a great example of this, and so I kind of gave that talk and said, you know, not only was the talk successful, a lot of folks were really interested in it. There was so much more to say besides the 15 or 20 minutes that I did on the stage there, and so I decided to continue going after of talking about Sims. In terms of the disruptive thinkers, there's actually a lot of history here. Claude Berrabet has done some work and wrote a Naval History magazine article about the Naval Lyceum, which was a movement in the 1830s or so, a precursor sort of to the Naval Institute, where junior officers kind of threatened the status quo then. You had figures like Samuel DuPont in the years leading up to the Civil War, who tried to reform the promotion system and the personnel system. So there are other people throughout our naval history who have had an important impact. I think part of what makes Sims so interesting is the way he did this at almost every level during his career. You know, he did it as a lieutenant. He did it again as a commander and a captain. He did it again as an admiral leading in World War One. And then when he came back from World War One and set up shop as the president of the Naval War College, his second term, because he started before the war, he really took all of that he had experienced and learned and used it to shape the way the War College and the way the Navy approached new ideas. And so he's a really interesting example to look at in that disruptive thinker sort of way, because you can watch him mature and progress through the ranks and take on different roles himself, as not always necessarily being the innovator later in life, but instead the senior officer that gives top cover or helps find the innovator or helps someone junior to him develop the new idea. And so because of that interesting biography, he really is a great case study for the folks today who are interested in new ideas and innovation.
I want to give you an opportunity to relate one of my favorite stories about Sims and what first brought it. Maybe there's something about Sims and being a lieutenant commander. I don't know what it was, but I remember the first time I ran across Sims was as a lieutenant commander a decade and a half ago. And it was a quote of his that I wanted to tease out of you. And if not the quote, you can just go in general terms. But as Eagle One mentioned, in his last question, Sims was a bit of a troublemaker, and when the subject was important enough and it was something that he felt strongly about, he wasn't too shy about jumping the chain of command to address his issues if needed. But take for a moment and talk about the initiating revelation that started Sims down the path to eventually being called the gun doctor.
Yeah, so this is kind of the starting point of when William Sims first becomes not only an innovator and someone who's disrupting the status quo, but also he starts to rise in prominence in the Navy. He was a lieutenant at the time, kind of when the story starts, and he came off staff duty where he had been working as an attaché in the embassy in Paris. And he had orders to go back to sea because he had spent 3 years on shore, and it was time to go to sea, as we always do. And he joined the USS Kentucky, and they headed out to China Station where they were going to spend their deployment. And there's a whole lot of detail here about what Sims first did when he got on board Kentucky and his studies of battleship design and that kind of thing. But that kind of would feed his later history. The initial observation or initial change that he wanted to make came to him when they reached out to China Station and he'd gotten his sea legs back, so to speak. And he was in Hong Kong and he met a British captain named Percy Scott, a captain at the time, who was the commanding officer of the HMS Terrible. And Scott had spent years over multiple commands developing this thing that came to be called continuous aim fire. And the whole idea was to change naval gunnery. Even then, even in 1900, 1901, gunnery practices really hadn't changed that much for almost a century. And everything was still kind of relied on the gun director, the guy who was aiming and firing the weapon, individually aiming at the enemy ship, waiting for the ship's roll to be just right to try and time it to fire the weapon. And then, his crew would reload and they'd wait for the ship to roll a little bit more and they'd kind of try and fire the weapon again. It was relatively inaccurate. I mean, this is why Nelson refused to fight at anything more than about pistol shot, and why successful battles in the Age of Sail were very close range things. It's because the accuracy of gunnery was horrible. And in fact, during the Spanish-American War, during which time Sims was on shore duty in Paris, some of the statistics showed that American gunnery hit about 3% of the time or less at the Battle of Santiago and at Manila Bay. And that's a pretty bad hit rate. And we're pretty lucky that the Spanish were even worse than we were, to be honest. So Sims meets this guy, Captain Scott, who's figured out how to re-gear the guns and attach a telescopic sight to them, because guns in this period had these enormous ranges that were far more than, Constitution or Victory had, but they still didn't have accuracy that was any better. And so with the telescopic sight and the re-gearing, the gun continually pointed at the enemy. He didn't have to wait for the ship to roll. He could continually be cranking the hand wheel to move the barrel, because it was re-geared to be really easy, and keep it pointed at the enemy. And this now meant that you could shoot as fast as you could reload. So your volume of fire went up, as well as your hit accuracy. And it made an enormous difference in gunnery. And Sims watched this and saw the gunnery practice performed on Terrible and immediately clued in on the idea that, well, this kind of changes everything. So he learned how Scott did it. Percy Scott was more than happy to talk about it, showed him how he did it. So Sims took it back to the Asiatic Squadron and started trying it on American ships, and it wasn't that long before he had gun crews that were almost as good as the guys on Terrible who had been practicing this for a while. And so he wrote a report. He had been an intelligence officer working in the embassy in Paris, and so he knew how to write a good report. He wrote a report, he sent it home to the Bureau of Ordnance and said, hey, boom, here you go. We can rule the world. Look at this. We could take on a whole squadron with one ship if we can pull this off. And he never got any response from the Bureau. And he wrote another report. He kept working on perfecting his ideas and how he would do this with American crews and American guns, which were obviously a little bit different than the Royal Navy had. He kept writing these reports and sending them back, and he basically got ignored. And over the span of about 2 years, he wrote 13 reports back to the Bureau, pretty much getting ignored all the way along. until the Bureau decided, because they were being asked questions from some other officers who knew of this project that he had going, they decided they needed to prove him wrong because they didn't believe anything he said. And so they conducted their own test right there at the Washington Navy Yard, and they quote-unquote proved that what he claimed was impossible. Now, they did their test on dry land, shooting at a target that was on the water and moving, rather than from the deck of a moving ship. Physics are a little bit different. There's a lot of problems with the way they ran their tests. And so it was easy for them to kind of set up the test so they could claim they proved it didn't work. And then they put out message traffic, said, you can't do this, it doesn't work, nobody should follow these ideas. And so Sims got kind of fed up. And he did something that he later classified as the rankest kind of insubordination. He admitted it was not the most professional thing to do, but he wrote a letter directly to the president to outline what he thought could be done to make American gunnery better and how to go about doing it. And the president happened to be a guy named Teddy Roosevelt, who knew a little something about navies and knew a little bit something about gunnery, and understood when he read this letter that even if Sims was half right, this couldn't be a huge leap forward in the way the Navy fought. So he basically suggested or told the Bureau of Navigation, which ran personnel at that point, to bring Sims home from China Station and put him in charge of naval gunnery. And that's pretty much exactly what happened. He comes home, takes on the billet of inspector of target practice, and sets about changing the way the Navy shoots, and did it in a methodical manner, and did it with a training plan and visiting ships and conducting training himself, and did it in some really unique and interesting ways, and comes out the back end as a lieutenant commander, having fundamentally changed naval warfare, which is pretty impressive if you think about it, for a junior person to have that kind of impact.
Well, a big chunk of the history of Sims, though, is his struggle against the status quo. I mean, as you note in the book, he starts out in the 1880s with basically a post Civil War Navy of 17 ships, and then he has to fight against the inertia of people who are just content to turn into a job. And he struggles on everything in your book details a struggle against the mindset that says that what we have now is the best that we can do with what we have. Could you kind of discuss that a little bit? Where do you see this attitude of his coming from?
So that's a really good point, and it kind of takes me back to the purpose of the book here first, and that is, as you commented earlier, the book is not B.J. Armstrong's biography of William Sims. The book is William Sims's writing. I happen to have collected it, and I wrote an introduction to the book, and I wrote some introductions to the individual collected essays and lectures that kind of give some context for the reader so they can understand where this is coming from. But the vast majority of this book is Sims' own writing, and the articles he wrote for Proceedings or the lectures that he gave at the War College, which he turned into articles after having delivered the lectures. And one of these articles, lectures that started at the War College and became an article, is called Military Conservatism. And it is William Sims looking back on a career in the Navy and realizing that we are, by nature, a conservative organization. Navies, militaries are. And he kind of points out that, most big organizations and most professions really are conservative. They tend to be. They don't change quickly. They don't change rapidly. But he points out that for the military, for the Navy, that's a particularly dangerous mindset, because what you're risking is, the national security or the lives of the men and women who serve. Not adopting new ideas or being slow to adopt them could mean your enemy gets them first, and that can have really negative repercussions. So he wrote this essay on military conservatism that's really fascinating. I mean, you look at it today, and honestly, it could probably appear in the pages of Proceedings today with discussion of, you know, groups like the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum, Secretary Hagel's Defense Innovators Initiative that he put out before leaving office as SecDef, and these other movements. I mean, this is right in the heart of that discussion, the idea that we tend to be a conservative organization, and if we don't reflect on that, if we don't think about it and apply critical thought and reasoning to our jobs in order to overcome it, we're going to put ourselves in dangerous situations. And so it's a really, it's an excellent look from a century ago into problems that, quite frankly, we still have today.
I think that's one of the things that makes Sims so approachable, is the fact that, you know, you could bring Sims back to today, do a 30-minute lecture on modern weapon systems and challenges, and he would get it. He'd be up and running. He's very much of a modern man, and a lot of things that we talk about that we think are in a modern context, they very much apply. And I wanted to encourage those that haven't ordered the book yet, that if you're wondering whether this is a book that even, you know, BJ's right, he makes a little bit of commentary and sets the scene, but it's mostly Sims. It's the Sims highlights. But when you crack open the book, it opens, BJ as the editor opens with this little paragraph here that I wanted to read. Quote, "In 1911, Captain Alfred Thayer Mahan wrote in his book Armaments and Attribution, 'The study of military history lies at the foundation of all sound military conclusions and practices.'" Unquote. 100 years later, as we sail even further into the 21st century, we are commonly told we face the most challenging circumstances in history, or that it is more dangerous now than ever before. These exaggerations tend to ignore the lessons of strategy and policy that come from our past. Unquote. That's the opening paragraph of your book, 21st Century Sims. And it brought to mind to me the last decade and a half has been dominated by what I derisively call the transformationalist mindset. And it's still prevalent, though the tide has abated a bit in the last few years. But there's this constant refrain of war is new, all is new. I've got a great plan that's going to fix everything that all the previous people didn't get. This whole mentality of the futurist that isn't looking back at all. And you're not alone in the fact that you've reached back to bring from Mahan and now Sims those concepts that really are fresh. They really apply to what we're talking about today. Is this a move, perhaps, that you're part of, that they push back against the transformationalist mindset and perhaps tapping everybody on the shoulder and going, there's no reason to walk into this dark room. There's a great flashlight right here that I can give you.
I think that I don't know that I would characterize it quite in that way as a pushback.
Sure.
As General McMaster has kind of talked about, you know, what this gets to is that fundamental relationship between the nature of war and the character of war. And the fact that the nature of war really doesn't change, yet the character of war does and should change, and that's part of the deal. And keeping up with the character as it changes is a challenge. And so some of the, we'll use your word, more transformationalist ideas are addressing the character, but don't understand that that's different than the nature of war. They think it's the same thing. And it kind of comes from a lack of education, reading, deep thinking on the philosophy of strategy and the philosophy of war. And there's ideas here. This is human interaction. And so the paragraph that you read is actually not kind of from the book. The paragraph that you read is the preface or introduction to a new series of books that we're going to be doing at the Naval Institute Press that we're calling the 21st Century Foundations series. And so I've been asked to come on board as a series editor to take this idea and continue to move it forward, that what we have in our past are examples that help us derive principles or ideas that can inform the present. It gets to this idea that, you know, so many people read their history looking for a checklist. We tend to have an engineering mindset, as particularly as naval officers, but as military officers in general, we run checklists. And we want to study history because history is going to tell us what to do because this worked last time. That's not how this works. It's not how the great ideas of the past work. What we should be reading them for is to help us ask the right questions. Because as the character of war changes over time, and as the challenges change, the questions will probably stay relatively similar, but the answers should be different, right? So we might ask similar questions to what William Sims asked in the period of World War I. We can learn from him to help ask good questions that will give us the right answers. Not the same answers as he had, but the right answers for today that addresses today's character of war. And so I think that the question gets at is this idea of how we study our history, how we study strategy, how we study the military past and the military art. And I think it's important for us to remember that the ideas of the past have great relevance today. But it's all in how you think about it and all in how you use it. So over time, there have been all of these great thinkers and writers who have written essays or papers that sit in archives today, you know, that are quietly ignored by us in the digital world. And they're just sitting there. You know, Sims's material has just been there for 100 years, and hardly anyone has looked at it. So we can go find these, and my goal is, as the series editor, is to help find other editors, other authors, who will bring some of these figures out for us and show us why their ideas are relevant to asking the right questions for today so that we can properly identify the character of war in the 21st century while recognizing the nature of war when we see it.
Yeah, somewhat in line with that. Part of the book that really interested me was his discussion of the general German staff and its application to militaries in general, but specifically to where he saw where he saw the U.S. Navy needing to go, in the sense of he distinguished between blind, what many people think of the military as blind obedience to orders, as opposed to giving initiative to your juniors after letting them know what you want done. Could you discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, the section that you're talking about is the chapter that's made up of his lecture, once again a lecture turned into an article on military character. And so Sims was invited by the Bureau of Navigation in the years leading up to World War I. Now, World War I had started in Europe, but the U.S. was still a neutral country. But the Navy recognized that there was a good chance that something was going to happen, whether it involved us entering the war or it involved us needing to defend our own coastline and our own country more aggressively than we had been. They were going to need a bigger force in the coming years. But they didn't have the authority, really, to raise more troops, right? Congress had not increased the size of the Navy. And so they initiated something called the Naval Volunteers Program. And the whole idea was to take volunteers who were interested in the naval service, who might, if a mass mobilization happened, want to sign on with the Navy, and to give them a little bit of training and a little bit of experience early on so that they could, you know, hit the deck plates running if things really went bad. And one of the parts of this program was a series of lectures that notable figures in the Navy were asked to give to this group of volunteers during their training. And Sims was asked to give a lecture on, quote, military character, unquote, which is obviously a relatively broad subject matter. And as he thought about it, he thought the stereotypical way to go about giving this talk was to talk about the great leaders of the past, right? But that discussion of the great captains tends to be more informative of strategic level decision makers and senior officers. And he knew he was addressing an audience that was about to become junior officers or NCOs or enlisted sailors. And so that discussion of the great men wouldn't necessarily inform them about their day-to-day job. And so he instead, you know, designed this lecture turned article in Proceedings around the idea that he wanted to address junior leaders. And in doing that, he talked about something that today has a different name. He talked about mission command. And General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and joint doctrine writers and parts of the Army, are aggressively working this idea today that mission command is the proper leadership model for us going forward as a joint force. And mission command is based ostensibly in the Prussian military of the mid-19th century, and it's based around this idea of giving mission orders and avoiding micromanagement, right? The commander is supposed to give his subordinate orders about what he wants achieved, but not necessarily tell them how to do it. Now, Sims takes this and he starts writing about this very idea that a century later we've rediscovered as something new. And he fundamentally boils it down for the junior officer to a balancing act between the conflicting traits of loyalty and initiative. In that you have to have loyalty to your unit and to your commander, loyalty to do what they tell you to, but you also have to have initiative to recognize when your idea is the better idea, the right way to go about it, or maybe your commander didn't have the right information and something has changed, and you need to act on your own initiative. And these two ideas, loyalty and initiative, are in natural friction with each other, and that a good junior officer or a good NCO understands that and is looking to figure out how to balance, knows when to be loyal and when to show initiative, and vice versa. You know, today a lot of the discussion of mission command tends to focus on the idea that the senior officer should trust the subordinate, trust the junior officer. And a lot of this is based on kind of, you know, angst coming out of junior officer corps, which has had a lot of responsibility during the last decade and a half of war. So they don't want to be micromanaged. They don't want to, you know, be over-supervised as we come back to a non-combat military role here hopefully in the future. And this focus on that trust and the importance of the leader's trust and how senior officers are responsible in this mission command idea has been written about a whole lot. And I thought it was really interesting to bring Sims' ideas forward because he approaches it from the opposite end of the spectrum. He reminds us that the junior officers and the mid-grade officers actually might have the harder job here because not only do they have to figure out this loyalty and initiative balance towards their superiors, they also have to realize that their subordinates are doing the same thing to them. Navigating those shoal waters is the real challenge of mission command.
I think one thing you brought up again early on in the book is, you know, in defining the character of the man, from character usually becomes actions. It became real apparent when he had reached the senior ranks in World War I, that he still kept an ear towards the ideas and the innovative concepts of junior officers like he once was. Almost like, you see an admiral walking around with a Jopa patch on. He still seemed to have that sympathy. And in a sub-paragraph that you had real early on in the book called Insurgent or Intellectual, it almost seems, in many respects, you could define him as an intellectual insurgent, because in the run-up to World War I, when America finally threw its hat in the ring, back when there were lots of lieutenants in command of ships, there were lieutenants who had been experienced in the War of the Atlantic, who had some great ideas, but the Royal Navy just did not have the right leaders to have an open mind for it. But when Sims showed up, he quickly opened up his ears and listened and talked for a little bit about how quickly that process took place and how important his listening to those junior commanders were in really doing something important for the Allied powers.
Well, he writes about it himself in his book, The Victory at Sea. When he came back from World War I, he teamed up with a guy named Burton Hendrick and wrote a book that was kind of part history, part memoir of World War I and the war from a naval perspective. And it actually was very well received. It won the Pulitzer Prize in 1921. And he talks about his experience in going over to England. He's first sent over to England in an advisory capacity, right? The war had not reached America yet. He had not entered the war. And he's sent over there undercover. Like, he is booked on a liner with a fake name, with his aide under a fake name, and they are in civilian clothes, and they are going over to London to start catching up with the Admiralty. Part of the reason Sims was picked was because he had such a good relationship with his friends in the Royal Navy, including Jellicoe, who was the first Sea Lord at the time. And so he gets sent over to consult, to bring the American perspective up to speed. And one of the first things he discovers when he gets there is that the U-boats are having a far greater impact than anybody is admitting. The reports in Lloyd's List and in newspapers in England tended to be overly positive. They weren't false. You know, the Royal Navy was giving accurate information, but they weren't giving the whole picture to the reporters. And the reporters didn't know the right questions to ask. And as a result, when Sims arrived, he had no idea how dire straits were. And he got briefed by the senior leadership of the Admiralty and realized, oh, they were talking about by the end of the summer, you know, Britain being on the verge of starvation. And the U-boats really had to be taken care of. And about that point, you know, the beginning of the summer there, the U.S. enters the war. And so Sims is there and starts hearing this conflict that's going on in the Admiralty. The idea of convoying ships had been suggested by destroyer skippers up the chain of command. And in defense of the Admiralty, to a certain extent, the Admiralty's concern was defense of the fleet. You know, they had to keep the fleet safe, and torpedo boat attacks against the fleet were a major concern coming out of Germany. And so they had to keep a certain number of destroyers with the fleet in order to defend it against U-boats who were coming in that regard. And arguably, they just didn't have the resources. And so what they did to hunt the U-boats was to send ships out individually, you know, basically just looking for U-boats. They were given sectors to go search, and they were just kind of randomly flailing around looking for U-boats. And it really didn't work at all. And the lieutenants that were the COs, lieutenants and lieutenant commanders that were the COs of these destroyers in the Royal Navy, you know, they wanted to convoy. They figured, look, if we can gather these targets together, the U-boats will come to us. We don't have to flail around searching for them. And if we've got a group of us convoying, we can swarm attack that U-boat, and we could do a lot better than we're doing now, because right now, we're not really doing anything. And so Sims shows up, and he hears this, and he had helped develop American destroyer tactics in the years, 1914 to 17 or so. He had been stationed at Newport and commanded the flotillas there, developing these tactics, working with American lieutenants that were destroyer COs. And so he immediately kind of understood what they were saying, because he had commanded such units. And so what he approached the Admiralty with was, look, I think these guys are right, these JOs are right, but I understand your resource constraints. Let me help. Why don't we bring our destroyers over and let us plus up your destroyer force, and we can start convoying ships, because we'll have the numbers of escorts that we need to do this. And they did it, and the Battle of the Atlantic, the first Battle of the Atlantic, the fight against the U-boats there in World War I, basically turns over the course of that summer. It's that fast. Like, they start convoying, it's successful, ships are getting through. And if you think about it, the American Expeditionary Force, the Army under Pershing, there's no way that they make it to England and then to the continent without a secure Atlantic, you know, line of communication. So this success over the U-boats is rarely recognized in the history of World War I for its importance. You know, the Army gets to Europe and starts its fight, and so then we get to hear about Belle Wood, and we get to hear about the Meuse Argonne, and we get to hear about the great battles that the U.S. participated in. But nobody ever asked the question, was it a foregone conclusion that they would get there? And it really wasn't.
Claude Barrabee has asked a question that's going to throw us backwards a little bit, but Sims writes that letter to President Roosevelt saying, they're ignoring me about naval gunnery. Did he have a pre-existing relationship with the president that would allow him to write such a letter? Because I can imagine if, you know, you or I wrote a letter to the president of the United States that we'd be in more serious trouble than Sims apparently ended up being in.
Well, yeah, a pre-existing relationship might not exactly be the right way to put it, but he did have an inkling that the president was going to read his letter. Now, there were a couple reasons for this. The first one was, actually, back in those days, presidents read stuff that came into them. They parts of their staff read the letters that came into them and actually forwarded along things that were of interest. And knowing that Roosevelt was a navalist, it wasn't necessarily that much of a stretch to think that when one of his staff members got this and read it, said, yeah, the boss actually might be interested in this. So there was that. But the bigger reason that Sims kind of knew that his letter would get through was during his years in Paris. When he was in Paris, it was during the Spanish-American War and the lead-up to the Spanish-American War. And Sims was working out of the Paris embassy. And he had been traveling all around Europe. He had responsibilities in Russia as well as there in France. And he bounced around a number of countries. He had picked up languages during a period before he went to the attaché duty that we can talk about later when he took a career intermission. But anyway, so he bounced around Europe a great deal. He had learned all these languages or picked up on them. You know, didn't really necessarily speak them fluently, but understood enough. And he actually started a spy ring in Spain. You know, the lead up to the War of 1812, the Spanish-American War wasn't, you know, instant, right? There was all the press, there was all the run-up to the war, there was a lot of tension there, and so Sims knew that there was an interest here, and as an intelligence officer ostensibly working there in the embassy, he basically started a spy ring in Spain. And arguably, he was the only one providing valuable intelligence back to the Navy. The State Department folks in Spain and in Southern Europe were not really that helpful, possibly or mostly probably because they didn't know what to ask or what to look for. We didn't have an intelligence apparatus in those days. The military was it. And so Sims's reports from his ring there in Spain and his coast watchers and folks that he tried to work in government as sources turned out to be pretty much it. And so he'd write these reports, intelligence reports, and send them home, and there happened to be a guy sitting in the Navy office as Assistant Secretary of the Navy who was really interested in whether this war was going to start or not. And Assistant Secretary of the Navy Theodore Roosevelt read Sims's reports voraciously. And he wanted to know the instant one of these reports came in from Paris. And so as Roosevelt gives up or resigns his position as Assistant Secretary of the Navy to take his commission as a volunteer in the Rough Riders as a lieutenant colonel, one of his last acts as Assistant Secretary of the Navy is to send a letter to Paris to Sims, in which he told him, hey, you're it. I have been reading these reports. You are fantastic. Keep up the great work. Thank you for your service. To use a modern phrase, not a phrase that he used. But yeah, so he had had this contact with Roosevelt several years before. And lo and behold, I mean, really, you're only talking about a couple, 3 or 4 years, and boom, Roosevelt's the president, and he's there when Sims needs to write a letter.
He didn't just talk about the larger issues of ships and things of that manner. He also talked about some of the more practical day-to-day cases of leadership and leading sailors. And looking at a modern context, everybody likes to talk about screamers or that negative leader that we have out there, and that's nothing really new. Captain Graf of the star-crossed cruiser Calpins, that particular leadership style, that it has a history in our Navy and militaries in general. Though the context of his time, I think it'd be interesting if you could flesh it out a bit for the listener. His context of within his living memory of abusive relationships and now might be slightly different. But he did speak in his 1916 lecture on military character, and a little quote here, quote, "The disastrous effects that may be caused by bad manners, lack of sympathy and tact, ignorance of or disregard of the elementary principles of governing men, and mistaken ideas of punishment." What were some of his, unquote, what were some of his thoughts about, an officer who's leading, whether it's a half dozen or a few hundred sailors, and what's the right mindset and what is the wrong mindset that one should have?
So what you're getting at with that question is really the kind of the back half of that military character essay. The front half, as we talked about before, is his discussion of mission command and that balance between loyalty and initiative. And in the back half, he tends to get a little bit more practical, and he starts telling sea stories because he wants to hold the interest of his audience, right? You've got to remember he's speaking this to a large audience of a couple hundred folks. And so he starts telling sea stories, and he starts talking about examples of leadership failures that either he personally has seen or that friends have told him about. And some of them are probably apocryphal, sea stories that get passed around the fleet sorts of things. But I think we all recognize that sometimes the negative leadership examples can be just as educational for us as the positive examples. I mean, many of us, frankly, probably everybody who has served has an example or two of people they worked for that they said, I am never going to be like that. Or at very least in a situation where they said, I am never going to react that way ever again. And so it's that kind of mindset that he approaches the second half of that essay. So between these sea stories, he also comes out with about 20 short and numbered lessons that leaders can think of and apply. And when he gets right down to it, and this is something that I kind of wrote about an excerpt from the book for our friends at Strategy Bridge, the blog, when they were doing their military profession week. When he gets right down to it, it's a lack of self-reflection and self-awareness. When you see these examples of poor leadership, they tend to come from officers who aren't thinking about what they're doing. They're reacting purely in the moment, and they are reacting based on some kind of maxim or checklist lesson that they were given at some point. You know, you will always treat sailors this way, or you always treat Marines that way. And the lack of self-reflection and actual thought about what you're doing, why, and what impact it's going to have is what Sims is warning these young potential future young officers and young NCOs about. And that reflection, that kind of almost philosophical approach to leadership, is what he is trying to inspire them to use. And the result is some of these suggestions, this number of about 20 ideas that he throws out there about, and they're not things just like take care of your sailors, right? Which sounds lovely and paternalistic or maternalistic, but isn't really that helpful to a frontline leader or deck plate leader. Instead, the suggestion is things like help your sailors study whatever they want to study and encourage them to come to you with questions. Well, now that's kind of specific. And so a number of these lessons are, you know, enumerated in the back half of that essay that I think are great. And they once again, it gets to that idea that I talked about earlier, kind of at the strategic level, but now at the practical deck plate level, asking the right questions. How is what I'm going to do as a leader going to impact that human being as an individual? You know, I said it earlier, we tend to have an engineering and a checklist mindset in the Navy. So we tend to see our sailors sometimes maybe as cogs in the machine instead of as human beings. And that sympathy or that empathy, that ability to understand what they're going through, is hugely important to good leadership. And it's the thing that these bad examples, whether from the past or the present, they really illustrate is a complete lack of empathy and understanding of what that thing you're doing is going to do or impact, how it's going to impact that individual human being that you're trying to lead. Because that's what leadership is. Leadership is human interaction at its purest. You know, it's we've got administrative processes that go in there. Yeah, we've got computer-based systems that help us track it. But at its fundamental, it's person-on-person human interaction. And that's what Sims is getting at there.
One of the other, I think one of his farewell speeches, I think you put two in the book, to the Naval War College, he talks about the importance of not just looking at technical issues, but knowing military history. Can you kind of touch on that a little bit?
So I think you're talking about the practical naval officer lecture, and that's, like you said, one of his graduation, I think it was a graduation lecture, for the War College class that was leaving. And he kind of frames this as a discussion of what it takes to develop the strategic leader, the senior leader in the Navy. And he lays out three elements that go into this creation of the leader who is able to lead in wartime and make the strategic decisions and the policy decisions leading up to wartime that will put you on the right footing or will lead to success and victory in combat. And those three things are, first, an understanding of our past, an understanding of the great minds of strategy and history. And so an education program, for kind of lack of a better description. He was a true believer in what the Naval War College did and what it taught. And this is kind of a place where, you know, early on in his career, he had a run-in with Mahan. He actually had two run-ins with Mahan. The one closer in time period to what we're talking about now was when, in 1906, he and Mahan had dueling articles in proceedings that drew completely different lessons about the Battle of Tsushima and what it meant for fleet composition. And Sims basically wrote an article that said, no, Mahan is wrong, which is pretty gutsy for a lieutenant commander to write about the great navalist in that way. He'd also had a run-in with him when he was a midshipman, and Commander Mahan was an instructor at the Naval Academy and wrote Sims up for being insubordinate one night for mouthing off to the duty officer. But later on in his career, Sims becomes of the Mahanian school when it comes to how to prepare a naval officer for the highest responsibilities of leadership in combat and in strategic and policy decisions. And that starting point is the education program at the Naval War College that teaches strategy and teaches policy in a way that's intellectual and scholarly and philosophical. Deep reading of the classic texts of the past to help build an understanding and a knowledge and a starting point, a foundation on which the rest of the leader's career can be built. The second kind of pillar of this three pillars to his educating the strategic leader is something that was not done as much prior to him taking on the responsibilities of President of the Naval War College, and that he really just kind of drove into the culture of that place that still exists today, and that's wargaming. He said that after this education, after learning these ideas and these principles and how you ought to apply them, you have to practice it. You don't want the first time you have to make a strategic decision to be in combat. You know, as a senior leader, as an admiral leading a fleet, you ought to approach the different permutations and different challenges and different attacks and threats so that you might have started to train your brain in the methodology of how to respond. Not necessarily that you'd have the same answers, but a methodology to approach it so you can make your decisions quickly, because otherwise you lose the initiative in combat. So wargaming is a fundamental part of this preparation in his mind. And not wargaming in the way that it's sometimes looked at in the Pentagon today, right? The wargaming in the Pentagon today is generally seen as a way to derive data for the operations research guys to crunch, to then come out the back. And so the war games are filled with think tank folks and, you know, senior leaders from the Pentagon. And the idea is to test out these ideas and crunch out data, you know, spit out data into Excel spreadsheets that then the OR guys can go and do their math and tell us what's right and wrong. That's not the kind of wargaming Sims is talking about. Sims is talking about playing out battles on the tables at the Naval War College with lieutenant commanders and commanders who will learn from this experience. Yes, they probably will. They hopefully will develop new ways of doing things and new ideas, new applications of those historic principles they learned about in their education. But the reason to start those war games is to start them in building a thought process and how they approach strategic decisions in combat. Now, the third element of these, you know, these three pillars is personal professional study. Sims showed up himself as a student at the Naval War College in 1912 and stayed on as an instructor in 1913. And he came to the realization while he was there that he really had not prepared himself well to be a senior leader in the Navy. He hadn't been reading. He hadn't been studying military history or international relations or how countries interact with each other. He hadn't been studying war really in any way. He had kind of just been doing his job. And so he comes out of his experience as a student at the Naval War College realizing that time there in Newport, it didn't teach him what he needed to know. It taught him all the things that he didn't know and needed to go learn still. And so that pursuit of personal professional study, reading, thinking, talking with friends, coming together in groups of officers to talk through the things you've read and learn. There's been some interesting writing from Dr. Mann and from Nate Finney at some of the blogs recently to Army guys about this idea of leadership through mentorship in groups, you know, the beer call or scotch and cigars together to talk about the things we've learned and what we've read. And that's what Sims is encouraging here in his third pillar, is this personal professional study that has to go on throughout a career. It has to start when you're a junior officer and has to build all the way through your years to becoming an admiral. You know, professionalism is about much more than the shine on your shoes. It's about what you know and how hard you've studied.
Well, Vijay, speaking of studying hard, I know that you're mostly working to finish up that PhD, to move on from being a PhD candidate. But what are some of the other events you either have scheduled or you like to have scheduled in the 21st century rollout? Are other places, people who might be interested in seeing your writings on this and other things, where they can find you and read you?
Thanks for that, Sal. So I've had a couple posts out online at different blogs and whatnot. At Beyond the Objective, which is Dr. Mann's new blog that he rolled out after his retirement. And then also at the Strategy Bridge and at the Naval Institute blog, I've done some writing about Sims and about some of the ideas that you can read about in the book. Coming up this Thursday is the SimSec's first Forum for Authors and Readers, the CFAR. And they've asked me to be the keynote speaker and to open their kind of mini conference with a little bit of a discussion where we'll be talking about professional writing and personal professional study kind of through the lens of William Sims and his history. So that'll be on Thursday. You can still RSVP if you're in D.C. You can find it at the SimSec website. So please come and join us for some light fare and cocktails beforehand, and then the talk itself. I'll have some books for sale and for signature if you want to get an autographed copy of either Sims or the Mahan book. And then going forward, I'm really excited about this series from the press, the 21st Century Foundation series. We have 21st Century Ellis coming out next month by Brett Friedman, an artillery captain in the Marine Corps, where he looks at the writing of the you know, kind of classic Marine Corps thinker, Pete Ellis, and what he wrote in a similar time span to Sims. They knew each other at the Naval War College when they were both students there. And then we have two or three other projects that are either contract signed or on the verge of contract signed that'll come out over the next year to 18 months, hopefully, as we run through the production process. So we've got this out. We've got a running start, and we hope to get a good series of books together that can help introduce some of these kind of more classical thinkers and older ideas that sit in the archives to today's military officers and thinkers to help them build the methodology they use for asking.
Spot on. I think it's a great concept, and it really, really is something that people need to fill their brain bucket with. No reason to reinvent the wheel or to rack your brains for a radical insight when it's just sitting there in a book waiting for you to crack it open. BJ, as always, it is a great pleasure to have you on as a guest, and I appreciate Charity letting us borrow you here for a little bit. And I look forward to having you on again as a guest. And if worse comes to worse, we'll just check you in the chat room.
Thanks so much. I appreciate you guys having me on. Fair winds.
Thanks a lot, BJ.
And again, our guest for the hour has been Lieutenant Commander Benjamin F. Armstrong, U.S. Navy. He is the author of the latest book, 21st Century Sims. Appreciate everybody for joining us live or getting us on the archive. And please join us next week when our guest will be another listener favorite, Robert Barney Rubble, Captain USN retired. He is Professor Emeritus of the U.S. Naval War College. He also is the former Dean of the Center for Naval Warfare Studies at the U.S. Naval War College. Thank you very much for joining us, and I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Farewell, let us swear. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.
Looking for the perfect solution for dinner at home tonight? Pick up a homemade family bundle from Carrabba's to check all the boxes on your dinner list. Literally, feed up to five, starting at $7 each.
Check.
They're made from scratch.
Check.
Choose from homemade spaghetti and meatballs, Carrabba's classic family recipe lasagna, and more.
Check.
Served with salad and bread.
Check. Wait, I'm out of boxes.
Order a family bundle starting at only $34.99 at Carrabba's.com to feed your family dinner tonight the quick, easy way. Carrabba's, Italian worth talking about.
What you doing?
Ran out of space on my phone, so I'm deleting some stuff. Bye, singing dog. Bye, goal.
I pronounce you.
Bye, wedding ceremony.
Stop. At Metro PCS, you get two free phones with twice as much memory.
Really?
Don't say bye to your memories. Switch to Metro PCS and get two free LG K20 Plus phones with 32 gigs when you switch two lines. Metro PCS. Wireless. Figured out.
Coverage not available in some areas. Sales tax not included in phone price. Excludes numbers on the T-Mobile network. See store for details and terms and conditions.